throat. Double dutch, then turn on the mic with a thumb stroke. Subtle touch, cuddle clutch. Is this thing on like the fling with Mrs. King Kong this spring gone? Sing a song of slap happy crappiness. He came to blow like it was strapped to his nappy chest. Surely I jest. The best on a wireless mic, not an eye test. Yet I digress. But why stress? Try and remember when maybe bit the tender skinned babysitter Gwendolyn. The type to hit and run and go tell a friend. Word to El Muerto, Cucaracha, exoskeleton. He know, flow like interstellar wind. Toe a rap gin by his toe into hell again. 1-2 check, me too. Loose wreck, see through your gooseneck EQ.
His name's Doom. They wonder just who is he, but don't worry.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Off the Hour, CKUT's community news program. This is the Tuesday audition, and it's November 9th, 2009. On this edition of the program, we'll feature Groundwire. The news program is produced twice a month by community radio stations across Canada, bringing us grassroots coverage of local stories and progressive perspectives on national and international issues. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. We'll also be speaking with a member of a coalition opposing open-pit mining by Canadian companies in Mexico. But first up, we'll feature the latest from the McGill Daily Student Newspaper with their weekly feature, Unfit to Print. You're listening to Off the Hour, breaking all corporate and state-created sound barriers on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. To reach Montreal's Community News Collective or to get involved, call 448-4041, extension 6788. That's 514-448-4041, 6788.
Pousse dans vos oreilles, vous écoutez CKUT Radio FM 90.3.
From CKUT and the McGill Daily, this is Unfit to Print. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Unfit to Print. My name is Erin Hale and I'll be your host. We have two stories for you today. The first is a quick interview with Ben Kerwin, who wrote a story for the November 9th issue of The Daily on parkour. I talked to him a little bit about his experiences in Montreal and some of the highlights of doing parkour here. Our second is an excerpt from a work in progress fiction by our coordinating culture editor, Amelia Shabanak, in anticipation of the upcoming literary supplement for The Daily. But first, a bit on this week's issue. We had a special issue on urban form, in which our writers explored such issues as architecture, urban planning, and reclaiming urban space. Two prominent stories were one about an abandoned grain silo in the Old Port, which has been transformed into a work of sound art, as well as a story on sustainable roof design in Montreal, and how that's being incorporated on campus. So I'm here with Ben Kerwin, and he's going to talk a little bit about his badass hobby, parkour.
Parkour in most cities is fairly similar, just because most cities are built in a fairly similar way. But even but the thing about parkour is because it's meant to move you, like, sorry.
That's okay.
Can I just start again?
Yeah.
I guess you're editing this.
Yeah. So, all right, start now.
Okay. Well, moving through any urban environment is going to be roughly similar because cities are built in a similar way. But because parkour is meant to, like, the idea of parkour is to be able to move from one place to another as fast as possible, like, in your environment. The environment you're doing does change it. So, like, in places like the Olympic Stadium with a lot of broad, flat pieces of concrete and a lot of changes in elevation, the way you climb around is going to be different than an area with lots of railings, for example, or just, you know, just closer to level ground. So, you know, the way you move is, like, very much dependent on the way the space is built around you.
In your article, you mentioned how a really famous example of, I guess, parkour would be appeared in one of the James Bond films, where someone's sort of running around this building. Are there any... Can it ever get dangerous? Or are there any, like, urban legends about people doing some crazy thing? Or is that more Hollywood?
Well, there were a few really public incidents in the UK when parkour first started getting heard about, when people were starting to see some of the videos that were coming out of France, which is where the where parkour really developed, but they hadn't.
Was this in the 90s or?
Yeah, this is late 90s, early 2000s, I guess. But you know, some kid would see the video and be like, "Oh, parkour is jumping from, you know, one building to another." And there are a couple of incidents where kids would climb up onto a three-story building and, like, look over the edge and lose their balance and fall off, and then it'd get pinned on parkour. But in terms of, like, actual people who have been practicing parkour, the injury rate is surprisingly low because parkour is a rigorous training method, similar to a martial art in some senses. There's a lot of focus on being prepared for the obstacles or the jumps you're encountering. So even though like the scene in Casino Royale was shot, I think, without any tripwires of any kind, and obviously he's doing what would for most people be very dangerous movements, but because he's training for years and he has control over the situation and the environment, he can handle it without serious risk.
Rad. Besides the Olympic Stadium, is there anywhere else in Montreal that you like to do this, or people like to go?
Well, the Olympic Stadium is a big one, partly because it's such a large area with no real security presence. So
I won't tell.
What?
That was a joke. I said, what are some of your, I guess, favorite places in Montreal to go besides the Olympic Stadium?
Okay, well, the Olympic Stadium is one of the biggest ones, but there are quite a few places down in the Old Port and downtown, and spreading out from there. Basically, anywhere where there's you know, something more interesting, something more challenging than flat ground, you'd find people running. Saturday mornings, there used to be a big session that started in the middle of the Old Port, and just throughout the day, you sort of wander around, you know, experimenting with things as you went along. So it's not really... There aren't really specific spots so much as, you know, exploring around and seeing what you find and seeing what you can do with it, I suppose.
Again, that was an interview with Ben Kerwin. You can read his full story in the November 9th issue of The Daily. Up next is Amelia Shabanek reading an excerpt from her work in progress.
My days are now often spent sitting in the cool dampness of Tom Brown's workshop, watching him fuss with old machines or carve long, slim birds out of fragments of driftwood. He will spend weeks repairing an ancient typewriter, perhaps, or taking apart and reconstructing a telephone that's been around since he built his house in the 40s. I enter through the screen door in the back, and he will look up when he hears it creak open. "Anna," he will say, and nod in my direction to acknowledge my presence. After exchanging a few sentences we rarely speak, he content to devote all his thought to his task while I leaf through a book or bend over a few scraps of paper, writing a line every now and then as I watch his movements. Very occasionally, he will hum a tune or two while he works. Even less often, he will glance sideways at me and begin to recount a story that belongs to his younger self, a person I can only vaguely recognize. He will tell it slowly, not rushing. Glancing up every so often, he will take stock of my reaction to the time in 1934 when he was nearly swept off the side of Mount Washington by the wind. Later, this day went on record as having the strongest gust of wind ever recorded at the Earth's surface. Or he will look up to see what I think of his stories about flying supply planes between Tuckernuck and Muskeget. In those years, the beach had been wide enough that he could land his single prop on the stretch of sand right in front of his house. I would have liked to have known him then. When he has finished a story, an unspoken agreement necessitates that I tell one back, though my tales can never match the experiences he relates. On the odd days when I refuse and he doesn't argue, he will fill the space by telling me a story about myself when I was small. How his wife, Priscilla, took me out to the flats one August when I was 10 and showed me what scallops looked like. How after that I would go down to the water each morning and free all the scallops he had raked the day before because they have 32 blue eyes, Brown. You can't eat something with 32 blue eyes. Or he'll remind me of the time later in childhood when I flew over the handlebars of my bike and my father shoveled me, bleeding but defiant, into Brown's boat and took me to the doctor in town that way, because the road was out after a rain. These stories are always and only about me, stories involving Max he knows well enough not to bring up. On other days, I will tell him bits of stories I have fabricated, or maybe
Hello, and you're still listening to Off the Hour here on CKUT Radio. We just heard Unfit to Print, a special weekly feature from the McGill Daily newspaper, and we, unfortunately, due to technical glitches, had to end that one early. But you can hear the whole piece in full sometime this week on the McGill Daily's website, mcgilldaily.com. And right now in Montreal, it's 12 degrees outside. And the time is 5:14 in Montreal. So please stay tuned to CKUT 90.3. Groundwire is coming up next.
Artists Against Apartheid, the 11th edition. Remembering political prisoners in Palestine. Performances from the Antoine Boustros Trio with visuals by filmmaker Mary Ellen Davis. Seven Arrows, featuring Joe Grass, pedal steel, Rebecca Foon, cello, Andrew Barr, drums, Sarah Page, harp, Yuki Isami, flute,
Water to Sit,
and a duo performance on Oud by Sam Shalabi and Omar Dawashi. That's Wednesday, November 11th, 8 o'clock, La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. 8 in advance, 10 at the door. Tickets at Casa del Popolo. Info 514-664-1036.
So
co-sponsored by Tadamo and the Suoni per il Popolo
Special
Festival. This
Schoenberg
is a CKUT Radio
we'll
co-presentation.
This is Mary
Day
Black, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT on the air live for CKUT. Oh, what? CKUT. CKUT.
You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
I'm Ian Gormley.
And I'm Melissa Beckford.
Today on the ground,
I believe in my cause. I believe I have a strong case.
We're also fighting for the type of education that will transform us into citizens who will be committed to fighting all forms of oppression.
We'll also hear how the Correctional Service violates the rights of Canadians, and the authors of an investigative report suggest opposes the Constitution.
And later on in the episode, as the Olympic torch lands in Canada, 2010 Games resistors are hoping to dampen the hype.
That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire. But first, here's Ian Gormley with the headlines.
Groundwire has been following the story of Abdelkader Belaouni, a blind refugee from Algeria. This week, migrant rights advocates celebrated a significant victory in Belaouni's case. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff has more.
Abdelkader Belaouni, a blind refugee from Algeria, has finally won his right to stay in Canada after a long public struggle. On October 27th, exactly 3 years, 9 months, and 22 days after Belaouni took sanctuary in St. Gabriel's Church in Montreal to avoid a deportation order, he finally emerged from the church a free man with his permanent residence papers in hand. Abdelkader, or Kader as he is known by most, attributes his victory to the support he received from many of his friends, as well as the many demonstrations, letter-writing campaigns, and petitions which took place on his behalf. Here is Kader speaking to the press on the front steps of St. Gabriel's Church on the first day of his freedom.
I believe in my cause. I believe I have a strong case because I'm a very positive person. I was sometimes like sad, but this day, I know it's going to be coming one day. Just it took 3 years and 9 months. I know. So long.
Kader, who is also a contributor to CKUT Radio, has been hosting his own monthly radio program called Radio Sanctuary since 2006. Over the last 3 years, the program has been broadcast remotely from St. Gabriel's Church because Kader was unable to leave. But on October 29th, he hosted the show for the first time from CKUT's studios. Now that he has a status, Kader plans on releasing his second music album, writing a memoir on his time in sanctuary, and living a normal life in Montreal. For Groundwire, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff.
Since the Olympic torch landed in Victoria and its route successfully disrupted by protesters, a vibrant opposition movement has been reignited. The Van Rad Collective brings us the voices of residents resisting the games.
Coming back from a protest against the torch relay kickoff in Victoria, Jeanette, Wednesday, and Mark wanted to share their perspectives and their critics about their experience there and about the resistance to the Olympics and beyond. Also, in reaction to many activists for who the disruption of the torch relay was a victory, Like Gord Hill wrote, for the Olympic resistance movement, the Victoria description was a victory.
And a lot of people have been calling it Victory in Victoria, like hallmarking it as like this great success, you know, because the torch was diverted. And, you know, that has its positives and negatives, right? I'd say that it was a success for those people whose goals was to divert the torch, I guess, because it did have to go around, it did have to reroute itself. But I find that if you set your bar low, then it's super easy to succeed, right? But if your recognition of a struggle or if your recognition of the Olympics goes beyond merely having people pass that torch hand to hand in an impromptu ceremony, then you can look at it as essentially a failure.
I feel like this march was a good test on both sides. There was some police from the Vancouver Police Department that went there. They brought some RCMPs on horses from Vancouver, which were forced to quit the march because somebody threw some marbles down the ground. The horses were forced to retreat. It was a test on both sides to see how many people were there to protest against the Olympics, against the torch rally. I saw some people that were on the streets in a residential area waiting for the torch to pass, and some of them, they seemed just to like be waiting for a spectacle. Like some people were like really angry that we were disrupting the route of the torch. I guess it was a little bit of a deception to see like the lack of anger that was like within the crowd. Most of the people were there and some people were just like marching and protesting against the Olympic, but not so much showing like anger or threat, you know.
They didn't have their gear. They were fairly ill-prepared as far as I could tell, and they're not going to whip out their gun in the middle of a crowd like that. I mean, yeah, it's just one situation, one little example, but it took people way too long to figure out and to gain the strength to actually force those police out of the march and do what we need to keep fighting. We can't afford to be afraid.
There has to be a recognition about how over-encompassing these kind of structures are, that the longer we let them sit and the longer that we let them fester, the more we allow them to take root, the harder it's going to be to extract ourselves. The time is right for it. The climate's ready. It's not impossible, but that's why it's a struggle. You know, that's why it is a resistance.
You can find more information about the opposition to the torch rally kickoff, to the Olympics and beyond in the Olympics Resistance Radio Show of this week on radioforall.net, in the series Out of Control, or in ncra.ca. To get in contact with us, you can write at vanrad@hotmail.com.
Tune in to Groundwire next week for a special edition, the 2010 Games from the Ground, critical analysis of the social, environmental, and economic impact of the Olympics.
Thanks, Ian. In Toronto, students rallied on November 5th to push, plead, and demand a lowering of crippling tuition fees that they say are forcing them to live below the poverty line. From CHRI Radio in Toronto, Ome Sama Harhamtula reports.
On November 5th, post-secondary students from across the province of Ontario mobilized as part of the Drop Fees for Poverty-Free Ontario campaign to let their government know that tuition fees are too high. Ontario now has the highest tuition fees in the country, where undergraduate fees have surpassed the national average by over $1,000 and graduate tuition fees exceeded the average by $2,600. The Drop Fees campaign calls for changes to be made to current government post-secondary education policy that will positively benefit students and the sector in general. 2009 marks the end of the Reaching Higher framework, and thus this is an especially important year for the campaign. At the University of Toronto's Convocation Hall and then to Queen's Park, thousands of students from across southern Ontario took their message to the street. Here is what they had to say.
We are tired, we're sick, we're pissed off about this tuition fee increase every single year. And I think all these students just show that, you know, they are angry and they want this to stop. And McGuinty needs to listen to us, so.
I'm out here because I believe education, post-secondary education, is a fundamental right. And as such, it should be free. But not only are we fighting for free post-secondary education, but we're also fighting for the type of education that will transform us into citizens who will be committed to fighting all forms of oppression.
Families are already economically marginalized. Education becomes less and less accessible. And what happens when you increase fees, when you introduce flat fees, you just create more barriers for more racialized and more Filipino youth to actually achieve higher education and eventually participate, quote-unquote, in the system, right?
Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Sama Rahimtula from CHRY in Toronto.
A
Hey, yo, check this out. This is Flavor Flav, and you listening to C. Hey, yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy. And you listening to K. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy. And you listening to CKUT and the place to be from the Bronx to T.O.P.
Time now for a short break with music from Toronto's reggae artist Steel. From his third album, this song is Know For Sure.
Why do we fight each other for some simple things? Another mother cry cause his son got killed. Why does this madness go on? We take another life just a random will. Saying every time it's a big man thing. So why does this madness go on? But you should know for sure, your day is gonna come. You should know for sure, you never make the moon and the sun. You should know for sure, your eyes are watching you. You should know for sure, Jaja see everything you do. Me here say you just make a dopey still, but deep in your heart that was not your will. So how do you live from now on? Say me sure you didn't burn as a bad man still. Something change your life, make you do them things. Say how do you live from now on? But you should know for sure, your day is gonna come. You should know for sure, you never met the moon or the sun. You should know for sure, your eyes are watching you. You should know for sure, just see everything you do. A pure madness and another mother cry. My brother, let me tell you, it's my utmost will that we should come together now and do Jah's will. Let's just all unite, cause it really takes a village just to raise a child. The ultimate goal is to see them smile. Don't let them youth get wild. Cause you should know for sure, your day is gonna come. You should know for sure, you never met the moon or the sun. You should know for sure, Jah eyes are watching you. You should know for sure, Jaja see everything you do. Yes, another mother cried. Don't ask me why.
Welcome back to Groundwire, a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Heard on 25 stations across the nation. Visit us at ncra.ca.
Groundwire also supports local artists. The music you just heard was from Toronto's own Steel.
And now for our feature stories. Last week, Groundwire brought you the story of dentists who don't treat disabled patients because of a lack of training. This week, Voiceprint brings us the story of Canadians with intellectual disabilities who don't get the care they need, and the doctors who say they need more training.
There are 899,000 Canadians who have an intellectual disability in this country. By definition, a person with an intellectual disability has an impaired ability to learn. It is a misconception that an intellectual impairment is synonymous with mental or psychiatric illness. This impairment can sometimes cause difficulty in coping with the routines of daily life. A recent Queen's University report indicates medical students want more training to help them treat people with intellectual disabilities. Indeed, 93% feel training in intellectual disabilities should be improved. Voiceprint's Marjorie Nicolau spoke with one of the authors of the report, Professor Philip Burge, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Queen's University.
So were the results of the survey a surprise to you? I mean, how big is the problem?
Well, we were surprised because we sometimes find medical students are so focused on learning the information about how to diagnose and how to select the specific medical condition or disorder, and a little bit less focused on how they will relate to the person in front of them and how they will be perceived, and a little less worried about that. But that may be the nature of being judged in medical school greatly by getting marks for learning the data and learning information. They recognize that given that they will move on to their specialty training after that undergraduate portion of their medical school, where they'll have much more patient contact, that they actually care to do a good job and see the need for more training.
So people with physical disabilities sometimes feel they're not being heard. Is this also the case with doctors and their patients with intellectual disabilities, do you think?
It's definitely the case. They find that they get spoken down to, that they sometimes are ignored in favor of maybe a care provider or a parent or a family member that might be accompanying them. For that reason, a number of them either find it very frustrating dealing with the medical profession, or they shut down and just let other people speak for them. What happens sometimes is that there's a breakdown in that relationship. There is not an understanding between the patient and the doctor about the nature of the medical condition, the tests that are needed, or the treatment plan that's being proposed to really have a patient making informed decisions and cooperating for their own benefit.
Professor Burge, so we were talking about people not feeling they were being heard when they go to the doctors. This, as you were saying, can be detrimental to their care. Is that being shown in results? For example, are people with intellectual disabilities sometimes getting inferior care as a result?
There are studies from, Australia and the UK that clearly look at a group of patients and the service that they get when they go see their physician, and to what degree are their medical conditions picked up accurately by their family doctor and then treatment proposed to redress those or bring them back to a greater state of health. And they found that there are often missing conditions that in many cases may seem like minor conditions to some people, but when someone is not communicating their concern or they're not able to be understood by their family doctor in terms of what their needs are, that untreated and unrecognized and untreated condition can cause significant problems, significant pain. Very often we find people coming to our mental health clinic because of concerns that an individual with an intellectual disability is being aggressive. And often there can be a medical health condition that's unrecognized that is the underpinning to that aggressive way of communicating that some patients have when they're feeling that pain and not feeling like they're understood.
So the result can be a large amount of frustration and a feeling of dislike of doctors and the medical world for people with these disabilities.
Yes, and worse, it can lead to fatal illnesses that aren't recognized. Far too often physicians will assume that someone's intellectual disability explains their behavior, and they won't look further. And what that means is the individual patient may not get properly assessed by things like medication or counseling or some other support that would really improve that person's quality of life.
That contact excerpt was provided to Groundwire by VoicePrint, Canada's 24/7 audio newsstand. To hear the full interview, visit voiceprintcanada.com or call VoicePrint at 1-800-567-6755, extension 226.
November 20th marks the 20th anniversary of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Youth in and from Ontario foster care got together to discuss whether the convention goals around education are a reality in Canada.
There's some things that's been bothering me lately, so I think it's only fair that I share them with you. I need some answers, yes. Should a man think that he's better than his brother?
Okay, Article 28 is
talks about the importance and significance of education for children, to sum it up?
I think it's like a fundamental part of life, because if you think back, like, nothing great has been achieved without education.
Is education a right?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
What if you can't afford it?
You still have a right to go to school. Doesn't matter, you can be the poorest person or the rich person. Everybody has a right to go to school.
I think there's challenges. I think the challenges to post-secondary school is that people don't appreciate the right that they have, and they take it for granted.
Most of the teachers, once they hear you're a youth and a child in care, they think that you're a bad child, so already they start to label you, and they don't even treat you as fairly, because they think you're just going to cause trouble, and that's it.
I think education is the key for your success in your life, because you need to stay in school, no matter what it is. You know, where I come from, they have no education. You know what I'm saying? And that really pained me, because education for me has meant a lot to me. You know what I'm saying? Because I stick in school, I graduate, and now I'm in college.
Like, education is important, but compared to other problems that a kid in care might face, education is not really that important. Because if you're fighting to have a house, if you're fighting to family issues at home, if you have your own behavioral issues, school is important, yes, but you don't really realize it because there's so many other things that are so important in your life that you don't really care about the school.
Like surviving.
Or, like, we have friends too, but I think that we don't have the family support as much, so we don't go as far, and we don't think we need to go as far. And a lot of us get damaged through the care system telling us that we're not going to become anything, or we're not going to do this and that. So I think that's a big reason why.
I was having challenges in school because I couldn't focus due to other distractions with family and housing and that type of thing. And then it turned out, like, I developed a literacy issue because you're not doing your homework, you're not paying attention in class, you're constantly zoned out, and you're, you know, focused on your personal life.
Okay, 16, my mom put me back into care again with my little brother. I remember we're like, okay, fine, we're going to be together. Then my little brother, yes, we argue, yes, we fight, but that's my brother. He's my world. Like, if anything happens to him, like, he's like my own. And to see us, like, literally have to watch the car move away with my little brother, going to school the next day, what test was I focusing on? Yeah. I was wondering, did my brother eat last night? Where did he sleep?
And when you talk about right, oftentimes talk about resources that are connected to it. So who should be paying for that? Or
things should be free.
I think we should all sign up for lower tuition fees. I know I did.
Me too.
Yep.
I don't think there should be any tuition fees, because in Europe, their education is pretty much free.
Yeah, I don't think there should be tuition fees either.
I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of like, am I going to go to school, or am I going to keep a roof over my head? And that's what it comes down to a lot of the times.
And I think the other thing is that not everyone can actually get OSAP, because if you, like, were, you know, not bad, but if you had some challenges when you were young and you, you know, took out a credit card because you could, and, you know, you got some sort of bad credit, then there's a good chance that you don't qualify for OSAP. It is not my responsibility, right?
Thank you.
I'm in the care of the state. It's the state's responsibility to ensure they removed me from my parents' home. It is their responsibility to ensure that I'm in the best care and that all my rights are being met. And that I have a right to education. Yes, thinking in your
mind, does this man really care? Those were the voices of youth in Ontario foster care, the result of consultations by the Network Community Group and the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth. You can hear more on November 19th when the youth consultations are presented to the Ontario Legislature. For details, visit provincialadvocate.on.ca.
Are you ready?
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
Monday, and Thursday.
Look for the McGill Daily
in Shatner,
McConnell,
Leacock,
Art,
and numerous other locations.
Read about news,
culture,
commentary,
and letters.
Read it in class,
while riding your bike,
while taking a shower,
or while having sex.
And best of all, it's free.
You can also listen to the Daily's weekly broadcast Tuesdays after 5 here on CKUT. Next. context, the Correctional Service of Canada is violating the rights of Canadian inmates, says a new critique. From Montreal, Dee LeConte interviews the authors and asks, is the Correctional Service of Canada's map leading Canadians down the road to more rights abuses?
Nearly 2 years ago, in December 2007, the roadmap to strengthening public safety was released by Stockwell Day's appointed panel. It has since been embraced by the Correctional Service of Canada and the Conservative government. Last month, an in-depth critique, A Flawed Compass, was released in response. Lawyer and law professor Michael Jackson and former director of the John Howard Society, Graham Stewart, provide a human rights perspective on the policy paper. It challenges that the approach to prisoners' human rights is unconstitutional and that the prison guard union played a significant role in drafting the 109 recommendations made in this paper. The policy paper was drafted by a panel appointed by the Minister of Public Safety of the day, Stockwell Day. Embraced by the Conservative government, the Correctional Service of Canada policy paper argues that many human rights Canadian citizens experience should be earned by prisoners. As Graham Stewart explains, this contradicts the Canadian Constitution.
A right is a right. Panels like this do not have the authority to establish what your rights are. That's established through the Charter and the Supreme Court. So right off, the recommendation that some rights should become privileges that you earn simply fell outside of the Constitution. It was clearly not a mechanism that the Correctional Services of Canada could adopt. And that raised serious problems for us about the whole basis in law for the recommendations that they were making. And it became quite clear in the analysis that was done as they spent very little time, if any, actually looking at the implications of the law. Why is the law the way it is? How did it develop in that way? What kind of Supreme Court decisions and others had influenced its development? And we found that, indeed, there was nothing there. So we had to then write the history of the law and its development. What is human rights? How do they apply in prisons?
Public Safety Minister Peter Van Loan remarks that public safety is more important than prisoners' human rights. Graham Stewart responds.
What the minister has been saying is that, well, human rights are nice and fine, but public safety is his major consideration. And as minister, he has to look to that. Our position, and we think we have more than enough evidence to substantiate, is that human rights for those who are in prison or anyone else is not in conflict with a safe society. It's astonishing that when the issue comes up, he keeps talking past the issue of rights and implies that respecting the rights of prisoners puts the public at risk. No evidence for that. But not only that, it's really quite a frightening notion. If Canada is going to go around the world as it has, insisting in other countries that they respect human rights, but at home tell the public that respecting human rights can put everyone at risk.
Stewart also makes note that the panel that put forth these 109 recommendations were persuaded by the prison guard union.
Well, if you have guards that are saying, well, there's all this violence going on and there's all these violations of charges going on in the institutions, and the Correctional Services of Canada can't verify that, they can't substantiate it, and indeed they can't. The actual official statistics aren't anywhere close to what the union was claiming. Then it seems to me that there's some reason to at least be cautious. I mean, that would be good grounds maybe to do an independent study. But that didn't happen. They simply accepted it in the end. There's two problems here. One is that how could it be that the guards have all this data and the correctional administrators don't? I mean, if that's the case, if they're right and administrators are wrong, then you've got a serious problem in terms of the administration of the prison, in which case you should be finding out why they don't have this data. Surely that would be an area that you would want to have some recommendations on. On the other hand, if you can't verify the data, do you rejig the whole system? To me, at least as I'm reading the report, that there was this substantial willingness to accept anything plausible that the guards came up with, made that known before the study. It was central. The UCCO had access to the panel that no one else had that was really to the same degree. Most were limited to 25 minutes. They had 2 hours. They had a 50-page brief. The rest of us were told to couldn't have anything more than 20 pages. So the guards had a very particular agenda that was part of their whole reason for demanding the review in the first place.
Prisoner Peter Collins' comments on the roadmap's push toward earned parole, which is one of the main recommendations in the report.
When they talk about going back to an earned parole system, they make it sound like they're moving forward, but the reality is this was already in place back in the 70s and 80s, and it wasn't a very effective system back then. And the reason that it was changed was the result of incredible upheavals in the prison system back in the 70s that resulted in a number of parliamentary inquiries. And that's how we arrived at the CCRA, which is the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, which is a new act that was designed to be in compliance, to pull the prison system into compliance with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which had been implemented in the 80s. So now when this new panel is talking about removing rights or reducing rights, they're really traveling in the opposite direction, going back to a draconian world, or at least into a more draconian world of prison and repression, crime and punishment, that's already been proven not to be effective and, in fact, to be counterproductive.
Certain recommendations in the policy paper put forward by Correctional Service of Canada have begun to be implemented, including doubling the budget for upkeep and construction of prisons, increasing visitor security, and cutting back funding to prison programs like anger management and substance abuse program. This is Dee LeConte from CKUT Montreal for Groundwire.
That's the end of another edition of Groundwire, community radio news in Canada. All of our episodes are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you are interested in contributing or sponsoring Groundwire, email groundwirepitch@ncra.ca.
This edition was produced by CHRY Radio 105.5 FM in Toronto. We thank contributors and producers Alyssa Tute, Ome Salma Rahamtula, Dee LeConte, Voiceprint, The Van Rad Collective, Paul Daniels, and Aaron Lakoff. Music from Steel, off the album The Man, The Music.
Tune in November 20th for Groundwire's Special Olympic Edition 2010 Games from the Ground. Critical analysis from the social, environmental, and economic impact of the Olympics. Until then,
I'm Ian Gormley.
And I'm Melissa Beckford. Keep your ear to the ground. Last week on... Sorry, you're still listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 5:47 right now and 10 degrees and partly cloudy in Montreal. Last week on the show, we spoke with David Schechter. He's part of Frente Amplio Opositor, which is a coalition of environmentalists that are fighting open pit mining in Mexico. Last week, the court ruled that Canadian mining company New Gold's environmental permit was illegal, but that's not the end of the story, and we've got David with us on the line right now to give us a bit of an update. Hi, David.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you doing? I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So just quickly at the end of the show, we got a press release yesterday about the way that New Gold handled the court's decision about their environmental permit being illegal?
Yeah, they sent out a press release in response talking about the court ruling. And after talking to the lawyers in Mexico for the FAO who ended up putting the case forward, there was a large discrepancy in the stories. So when we looked into the actual court ruling, we saw that the company... In the FAO's eyes, wasn't being entirely truthful with shareholders. So we sent in a complaint to the British Columbia Securities Exchange Commission, which they're because they're on the TSX Vancouver, and we're hoping that they'll be able to sort it out and let us know, and let their shareholders know what's actually happening on the ground.
Okay, so
and in the court. Sorry, I know that's really complicated. but or that sounded a lot more complicated than it needs to be.
Well, why don't we backtrack a little bit to when do you want to just give us a very brief overview of a very big issue, I realize, sort of what the process has been with New Gold?
Sure. I mean, they've been operating a gold and silver mine there for around 3 years now. The first gold pour was in 2007, and they started blasting a couple years earlier than that, but they've had the property since 1996, and they've been exploring it since then. There's been widespread opposition to the mine, and that's been organizing, and there's been this building moment between the opposition and the mine, especially as it started operating and the blasting started taking away large chunks of the mountain, pieces of rock started rolling into the town, buildings started cracking, and the environment started to erode. And as that was happening, the opposition movement started growing, and for the past couple of years, there have been several legal victories and losses in the courts as they've been trying to figure out the legality of the mine. And in October, there is a ruling about their land change use permit. And it's extremely complicated between the different committees and the different court systems and the different permits in Mexico. And between that and the language difference, sometimes it's difficult to know exactly what's going on for a lot of people in Canada. But essentially, the ruling said that their land use change permit should be revoked by this Thursday. And the reason was that it went against two Mexican laws that were passed in the Congress, which declared San Luis Potosi an ecological reserve, as well as their environmental impact statement had 100 stipulations that they needed to meet in order for the land change use permit to be valid, in which the company didn't meet. So their permit was thrown out, and the court gave them until this Thursday to follow it. And then what happened with the Securities Exchange Commission Canada was just that the government's response was that the permit was still valid. And they said it was only the environmental impact statement that was thrown out and that it didn't impact their operation at all. So what the FAO decided to do was to lodge a complaint with the Securities Commission in Canada because they wanted, at the very least, the investors of the company to know that this court in Mexico stated that their permit was illegal, as well as the Canadian public and the media.
Okay, and we talked to you about all that on Friday, and at that point, it was the news was that the permit was illegal. And what you were saying on that interview was, this is a legal victory, but we realize that this isn't the end of it. This isn't the victory.
Exactly.
And
I mean, this is kind of showing that where the company's invested millions upon millions of dollars and a lot of infrastructure and capital on this project. So they're not going to immediately go just because the court said that they should. And in Mexico, unfortunately, a court ruling doesn't necessarily mean a victory for the people who got the court ruling on their side. And press releases that are muddying the issue are a part of that strategy in which to hope to try to erode Canadian support against the company and try to justify for the company to keep going. Because the more they confuse the issue, the less strength the court ruling has. Especially because of the fact that impunity isn't all, sometimes companies can run with impunity in Mexico, it's important to have pressure on the Canadian side as well.
And that's what you've been doing by placing the complaint with the British Columbia Securities Commission?
And that's part of it. That is the hope, is that the Securities Commission can, on the Canadian side, provide what can be considered a third party and considered a unbiased view on what the ruling was to the shareholders, because we realize that our side is considered biased, and it's easy for the company to portray us as a minority or to portray us as radical or as anti-development. But if the Securities Exchange Commission were to come out and state that this ruling was in fact what we say it is, that's a much stronger statement. And hopefully it's a statement that the shareholders will be able to hear.
Also in line with putting pressure on the Canadian side of things, is there a way for Canadians to get involved in this?
I mean, there are the normal cliches or normal statements of writing to your MP and getting read up on the issue and starting to get involved and everything. I mean, yeah, we have a, I don't even know it off by heart, the website we have, but you can start reading up on Canadian mining industry, because it really is, we make up 60% of the world's mining industry, and we really are the biggest players, and a lot of the things that are happening in other countries are from companies like ours, and they're not regulated. They operate in countries like Mexico because they know that the court system doesn't have the same strength as our country, and they know that they can get away with things they can't get away with here. So it's something that Canadians should get more involved in, but, I mean, there are thousands of issues that I could say that about. So I'm sorry. You've just caught me at the end of a long day.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for speaking with us. We're actually about ready to wrap up the show. Is there anything you want to throw in before we end this conversation?
Not very much. Sorry, I just rattled today. But have a great night, and thanks for letting me speak.
Okay, thanks, David. If you want to get in touch with David Schechter from the Frente
Amplio Opositor,
It is cerrodesanpedro@gmail.com. So cerrodesanpedro, pedro@gmail.com. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
So that does it for this week's edition, today's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. I've been your host, Jacera, and David was with me as well, and I have also been your sound engineer. Thank yous to all our guests and to those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, contact us, CKUT's Community News Department, at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned, we've got Native Solidarity News coming up next, and first we'll hear a bit more from Wooden Skies.
I wake up, you get in home. Well, I've been dreaming about mountains, and you've been dreaming about gold. And if I ever make it home, oh, if I ever make it home, my key won't open the door. Well, I've been thinking about selling off every shirt I own to stand naked out here in the trying to make it out on my own. Well, oh my God.